Tom Dillon is being interviewed by Renee Garalick for an oral history of his educational career. The interview is taking place at Concord Carlisle High School, where Mr. Dillon has taught for 37 years out of his 39-year career. The interview is taking place on May 7th, 1990. Mr. Dillon is 62 years old. Could you tell me how you began your educational career and your decision to teach at the high school level?
When I was a student at Tufts, during my undergraduate years, I found that I had to augment my income by tutoring my fellow students. And I recognized, in spite of the $2 per hour that I was getting, that I also got a big kick out of what I was doing, this idea of sharing my knowledge of science and math with my friends, I enjoyed immensely. And this made me decide to get into teaching as a career.
And where did you first begin teaching?
I began in a small town on the South Shore, Swansea, just outside Fall River. I taught there for 2 years, math and science. I was earning $2,200 a year. And at that time, Jack Donovan, the principal of Concord Carlisle, and Radcliffe Morrow, the superintendent, who himself was an ex-math teacher, by the way, Rad Morrow, came down to observe me teaching my physics and math classes based on an application report that I had sent to Concord. I guess they liked what they saw, and they invited me to come to Concord and teach physics and math in the fall of 1953 at a grand salary of $3,000. In those days, that $800 increase was tremendous.
Your home was in Arlington?
I lived in Arlington, and of course, that's one of the reasons I applied to Concord. It was geographically close. At the same time, I had no interest in working in the so-called inner city schools, let's say Somerville or Boston, but rather the outlying communities. I felt the townspeople would be more professional and would therefore hopefully raise more professionally oriented students, and I had proven to be right over the years. That's what it's turned out to be. I came to Concord for those two reasons. The tremendous increase in salary and the fact that the town itself was professional in nature and therefore could guarantee me good students in general.
At that time, the high school drew from a number of towns.
In the early 50s, middle 50s, we had Bedford and Lincoln students join us in Concord. It was still called Concord High School. It wasn't a region then. And then, not many, I would say perhaps a couple of dozen kids from both Bedford and Lincoln out of the, well, maybe 400 kids in the school as a whole. And then it wasn't until 1960, of course, that we became a region with Carlisle.
And there were 400 students, you said, when you arrived. How many faculty and science teachers?
We had 36 in the faculty, a principal and a vice principal, and a secretary up in the front office. We had four people in the science department. Joe Regan, he taught biology. Joe O'Brien taught chemistry. I had the physics and some math. And Gertie Dyer was earth science with some biology, the four of us.
I see. How does that compare today to the staff?
Now we have a faculty at the school of over 100 with 11 in science. And these 11, I might add, are all full-time science. Whereas the day that I just mentioned, the early 50s, we would be mixed. It would be math and chemistry, math and physics. But now we're all full-time science as opposed to the partial load we had back in the 50s.
And the student population is about?
The student population now is about 1,200 as opposed to 400 then. As I mentioned to you earlier, we had an 1,800 population in 67, I think, was our maximum year for enrollment. A staff of 120.
Mm-hmm. When you first began teaching, how would you describe the students?
Passive, They would come willing to learn, but playing the role of, I'm here, teach me. They didn't get too involved with the questioning. They were very responsible. They did their assignments. They were very well behaved, at least the kids that I had in physics and math. It was fun working then because it was not much of a challenge. You simply regurgitated what you learned yourself as a college or high school student and just related to the kids. It wasn't until the 60s when things began to change. In particular, the history of the country at that time, I think of the flower generation, Kent State, and the earlier years of the Vietnam War, when students in general, both college and high school, began to question authority for the first time. This was an awareness that we were not prepared for. And this is all positive, I might add. I'm not objecting to what went on. And now we find that the media has made the kids a lot more knowledgeable. It's a source of information we hadn't had for us in the past, meaning that the papers and the TV now tell the kids a lot more than we ever told them in the classroom. As a consequence, in the last 20 or so years, we find the kids are much more involved and question a lot more in a positive way. When I say question, they question authority, but they question what you're doing, why you're doing it, what you're saying, and this is very, very interesting. This is what makes the job challenging. In fact, almost every day, something different comes out of the classroom. Many people think that a teacher does the same thing over and over again, which is so far from the truth. Some people think. I don't know anybody who does. But the kids really today dictate the kind of curriculum that we offer.
So when you began, you would say the approach was more dictatorial?
That's a good phrase, dictatorial. That's how we were brought up. Well, the kids question, but not to the extent they do today.
And what corresponding term would you use for today's approach?
Today's approach, corresponding term, well, it's not passive, it's more active in the student's thought. The teacher is more of a guide than a director. There was a time when I was, I'll give you a funny line, the sage on the stage. And now I'm more of a guide to a learning process. Of course, they still need the authority of the facts. We still, as teachers, present factual information. But once that's on the table, then we kick it around in a lot more open way than we did in the past. And of course, again, the media is a great help to us in this regard, especially in science, because in the last even quarter century, so many different things have been happening. Since the early days of the space program, for example, that not just in physics, but in all branches of science, we can't help but have the kids get something outside of what their teacher tells them. And this they bring to school, and if it fits in our curriculum, we go through it, and that's what makes it so different from the earlier days.
Would you say it's more of a hands-on approach today, too?
Ideally, we like to think that the kids do more laboratory work now than in the past. In a sense, that's only partially true. The actual time spent in the lab is probably the same. It's the nature of what they do, though, in the lab that makes it different. In the earlier days, they were in the lab to confirm an already known fact, whereas in the present lab, meaning the last 10 or 20 years, they go into a lab trying to discover the fact of the law of nature that's being measured. So it's more of a discovery as opposed to confirmation experience.
And can you give me an example of certain media events that have become quite a discussion within the classroom?
Well, obviously in physics, the space program, I remember quite vividly at the time when this school was built in 1960, the rage in teaching was television. Now it's computers, of course, but in the early 60s it was TV. As a consequence, every classroom in the high school had its own TV built right in. That was very good for us in physics because this coincided with the space program. Of course, Sputnik was 1957, and our own program began in the early 60s, and you can perhaps recall, those of you who were around in those days, or at least able to read the newspapers, practically every other month, a satellite was being launched. It was a big headline event. Now it's just an everyday occurrence. Nobody even bothers to listen. It's not a special broadcast, but in those days it was. And I can recall on many occasions when the NASA headquarters was in New Jersey, as opposed to where it now is in Houston, the announcer from Cape Canaveral, that's what it was called then, now it's called Cape Kennedy, would announce the satellite has just taken off, it is now over Africa at a certain altitude. We will let you know as soon as we hear from New Jersey when that thing will pass back over Cape Canaveral. That was the clue, of course, to my physics class to get busy with the equations and try to figure out ahead of time at what time that satellite would return. And the fun we would get from watching the television and making our own calculation of this kind of data and have the announcer say within 1 or 2 minutes the time that we as a class had already figured out. So here's a classic example where the media definitely does affect what we do in the classroom. But today, a space shuttle is like a nothing. Unfortunately, the kids today don't appreciate the magnitude of what's going on.
What was the influence of Sputnik in 1957 on the teaching of science?
I have to point out that Dr. Bruce Olds, who was then chairman of the school committee in Concord, this is in 1958, and I was a freshman teacher, meaning only had a few years' experience, maybe half a dozen behind me, and he called my attention to a group of physicists who were meeting at MIT to form a curriculum writing team to redo all of high school physics. And the little article read, anyone interested, contact so-and-so at MIT. Well, he called this to my attention. I had missed it myself. It's just a small article on the back page somewhere. And thanks to Bruce's involvement, I then joined the MIT writing team in 1959. And for the next 25 years, I worked very closely with that group, generating all kinds of materials for both American high school students and foreign high school students. I was one of several. I was one of over 100 involved in this process. It is called the Physical Science Study Committee, comprising many, many high school teachers like myself, plus many, many college professors, including Nobel Prize winners, whose job was to revamp the physics curriculum for high schools. Now, the reason I went to great lengths responding to your question is that this involvement on my part over the years with the Physical Science Study Committee, plus the fact that it allowed me to generate my own textbook independent of this group, plus the fact that it gave me an opportunity to do a lot of teacher training because of my involvement in the curriculum, that is teaching teachers how to teach this new curriculum. These associations of my personal career have had a tremendous, I like to feel, effect on my classroom work here in Concord, primarily because clearly I would bring back, frankly every day, new ideas for my colleagues back at MIT, new ways of presenting materials, new curriculum changes. I'd have my own kids in Concord make changes by editing the material that we would bring. I've had several students who have found errors in the stuff written by these MIT people and ourselves. This would make me feel very proud that my own kids, many students, as well as other students around the country, could get this closely involved. Concord was identified as one of 8 pilot schools, I hadn't mentioned this earlier, but 8 pilot schools in the country were chosen to try these new curricula, and we started in 1960. Reporting back to the MIT group the things we found wrong and things that we liked. And editing was done over a process of several years, and the result now was now in a 6th edition. This particular curriculum is in a 6th edition. It's still being carried on, not by the original group, but by leftovers from the original group. The reason, again, I'm talking at length is because this has had a tremendous effect on what I do in my own classroom.
What is the name of the text that has gone through these successive editions?
It's called PSSE Physics, the Physical Science Study Curriculum Physics Course, published by DCV, first edition 1960, most recent edition, 1986.
That's very impressive. And you have subsequently done another, been involved in another text.
Again, my associations with this group has brought my name to the attention of others in the field, and I was approached by Harcourt Race and World, as it was called then, it's now Harcourt Race Jovanovich, to write for them a high school physics textbook vis-a-vis the PSSC program, because other publishers were concerned that the PSSC approach was so drastic that they would be losing out on textbook sales because of this new curriculum. So they tried to get others who knew the curriculum to do some writing for them to spread the wealth, so to speak, among the students who'd be taking physics. So I wrote a three-edition textbook for Harcourt Race, which is still being published. We use the third edition right now in one of my classes here at Concord. This being a direct result of my involvement with Bruce Olds's suggestion to go see those MIT people.
It's a good suggestion. How is the PSSC approach very different?
What it has done is taken out of physics what we used to call the traditional favorites, Archimedes' telescope, or rather Galileo's telescope, Archimedes' principle. These traditional favorites, it used to be just a collection of facts, the old book. You could take an old book and shuffle the chapters and deal them at random and still teach a course that no kid would know anything was being done differently. Whereas the new look, I'm talking 1960, the new look is one of a continuum, it's a storyline. Physics is a series of ideas built up on concepts, and you can't shuffle the chapters at random. There are a few places, of course, where a given topic can precede another, but in general, if the storyline is involved in the PSSC, and to teach it properly, you have to know that storyline so you can show the kids how the concepts of physics really are tied together, how one logically follows from the next. That's mm-hmm. the main difference. It's one of a continuum storyline of concepts rather than an isolated collection of facts.
Very good. You try your texts, your writings out on your problems, out on your students?
Yes. With the PSSC, there were so many of us working on it, that was not an obligation that I had, but with my own textbook, there are hundreds of problems, as you would imagine, in any physics book, and in spite of the fact that we, meaning my co-authors, work them out in detail, there's always that chance of making errors. So I had all of the examples in the first edition given to two students here at Concord. Bruce Holtsche, class of, I'm going to guess, maybe 71, and Peggy Furke, class of 71. They were two of my advanced physics students, and they had the job of working out all the problems in the textbook on their own at home. A lot of hours put in to check our answers. And they found some mistakes. And their compensation was nothing more than their name was listed under the credits in the textbook. No money involved. They enjoyed doing it.
Well, it's an enduring contribution. You've only taught physics. Has that helped prevent a burnout?
No, I've taught physics 100% for the past several years, and I've taught math for an equal number of times, because math, physics without math is practically meaningless. So math does go with the physics, they go hand in hand. No, you can get a burnout, I would assume. I've seen teachers burn out teaching certain curricula. I won't identify the curricula. But luckily for us in physics, in spite of the fact that a lot of it is circa 1600, namely Galileo, and Newton and Napcry were things factual. There have been so many changes in our area in physics today that there's no time for burnout. But more importantly, the kids are getting younger and younger every year, I notice. You know what I mean by that, of course. I'm getting older, they're the same age, hence they're getting younger. And yet, in spite of that, and they still know how to keep me, at least, on my toes. They still know how to make it interesting for me to walk into class. Burnout is never a concern with me. And people ask me, why are you retiring? You're only 62 or 63. And I have no answer for that. I still look forward to coming to school each day. I have no answer except that it's time. Whatever that means, it's time.
Life is passages. Is it an advantage to be teaching upperclassmen, because it's juniors or seniors that are taking your course, and perhaps the more motivated?
Yes. That's why I didn't give you a direct response to your earlier question regarding burnout. The unfortunate situation where some teachers have to teach all age groups and all levels of ability and all levels of attitude, I think bring on burnout much quicker. But as you correctly pointed out, in my case, where I'm all physics, and just by definition, the better kid takes physics, meaning in terms of ability, if you don't have a math background, then you couldn't do well in physics. So already I start with a good crop of kids. Kids that have a good math background, kids who are academically oriented, perhaps more importantly, kids that come from a town who has a lot of professionals, and you therefore expect the kids to be a little better student than the average, how do you want to put this, without being too obvious. I use the term gene pool. The gene pool in this town, I think, feeds my courses very well, and that makes it a challenge, and that makes burnout all the less significant.
Has the school committee and administration been helpful in providing the materials and support needed for you to teach?
I've already mentioned Bruce Olds. I can name a half dozen others over the years that had a specific involvement with us in physics. But more importantly, when I mention a professional town, a lot of our school committee people over the years have themselves been science professionals, which is, of course, great for us who are teaching science. But in general, to respond to your question, I have found over the years that the school committee has been extremely cooperative in funding practically any program that not a teacher wants, but rather that a group of, like a science department, for example, would suggest. They've been very, very willing to spend the money to try these new things, and I think the record will show that they have made wise decisions. I can recall any time in my career where they've said, they meaning the school committee or administration, they said, no, you can't do that. But rather, they've given us funds, they've given us, most importantly, autonomy. This is a very important point. To do your own thing in the classroom, of course, they obviously watch you. If you make a serious error, you hear about it. But in general, you're given complete autonomy, do your own thing. They know of you, they know your history. They know what you're capable of, and they must get feedback from the kids and from the parents on what you're doing. I'm speaking now of teachers in general, not just myself. So this feeling of school committee willingness to give us rein, to give us freedom to do our own thing. Now, I shouldn't say our own thing implying we're all doing something just to satisfy ourselves. We're doing our own thing in the sense that from working with our colleagues around the country in all areas, not just in science, now English, social studies, we like to feel we're bringing the best back to Concord, and that's why many of us at the school feel that without question Concord's the best school in the state, on both academic, not to mention the obvious salary advantages here compared to other towns.
There's been a high enrollment then in physics classes within the Concord community.
Yes. And there are many reasons for that I like to feel. One is the curriculum itself. I like to feel the word gets around and the kids hear about the course offering and sign up for. Secondly, I think, again, the professionalism of the town that I've just mentioned almost suggests that a lot of towns, if not most, would want the kids to take as much science as they could in high school. But we have a very high enrollment in this town. At one time, we had more physics sections in Concord than any other town in the area. At the moment, I'll simply say, not having checked the record recently, that if not the highest, among the highest total number of kids out of the population that are taking physics. In particular, we have 10 sectors of physics. This year we had 16 at one time, whereas most schools our size might have 3 or 4.
And you've opened it to a variety of levels.
Like most schools, we offer 3 levels of physics. Most schools, I should say, offer 2. We offer 3. The standard college track for the non-science major, but who could be doing all A work in English and social studies, but just a non-science major, that's our regular college curriculum. I said 3, there are 4 tracks on 3. And then we have, for the college person who has no math or science at all as an interest, this is our so-called non-college major physics, but still for college-bound students. Then, of course, our honors system, which is explains itself. And we offer an advanced honors course for the real bright kids who will hopefully do more work in physics in college.
And now you're getting ready to address this year's graduating class.
They asked me 2 years ago, would I give a commencement address? And I fibbed. I mentioned, I think it was a wedding in Philadelphia, because at that time I did not want to face that large number of people in June, students I'm talking about, not the stand, but the students, and then meet those same kids again in the classroom the following September. That is the kids in the stand. When they asked me this time, where I'm retiring myself anyway, I'm using the phrase they, referring to the town now, the administration, the students, the parents, they can't touch me, I'm leaving. So I'm wide open. I can do my own thing. And I told the kids I would certainly be honored to give them a little message at graduation, but I would do my own thing. And they said, we wouldn't want it otherwise. That's why we're asking you, because you're known for doing your own thing. So I don't know what's going to happen when they get graduation, but I certainly will preserve my dignity and that, as well as that of the school. At the same time, I can be sure of this, I will not be delivering a conventional graduation address.
Well, I wish you the best of luck as you enter a time where you can smell the roses.
That's good. Smell the roses.
Thank you.